You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. A dozen people in scrubs, fire department uniforms, or even matching t-shirts, are setting up a series of tents at a church parking lot in Watts. Orange traffic cones line up on one side, and a grid of chairs wait for people on the other. Today, 200 people are going to get vaccinated here for COVID-19.
How's everyone?
Yeah!
I love that.
And before the gates open, Joanna Rodriguez rallies those workers.
It is our last day here in Watts. Can you guys believe it? So as of right now, we've allocated more than 800 doses. So you guys can feel proud of yourselves. All right, guys, let's get it going. Let's get it going. Thank you.
800 down, 200 to go. Now, 1,000 people in 1 week might not sound like a lot for a vaccination site, but there are 1,000 people who are least likely to go online and book an appointment. Maybe they don't have a car, maybe they don't have internet connection or citizenship or a home address. This operation is a mobile vaccination site. The city of Los Angeles has 10 of them now. And they're deployed to parts of LA that have particularly high COVID numbers and particularly low vaccination rates. Places like the East San Fernando Valley, places like South L.A., Watts. KCRW's Kaylee Wells takes us to meet one of those teams that bounces all around L.A., thinking creatively about how best to get shots in L.A.'s hardest-to-reach arms.
Joanna Rodriguez is in charge of this week's site in Watts. Step one was figuring out where to bring the team.
I recommended Watts as one of my priority communities because this is where we're seeing the highest case number, but also that we're seeing a big COVID-19 trend in this area.
She represents the Harper and Watts area in Mayor Eric Garcetti's office. She also grew up here. She picked this church parking lot because it's where she spends her Sundays. It's actually not far from a pharmacy that offers vaccines. But Rodriguez has to think about more than just how far someone has to travel.
If you talk to people, anyone that does not know Watts, anyone can just say, hey, it's right there, it's right next door. Unfortunately, there's a lot of layers to it. A lot of people just don't have the transportation, but also the gang lines sometimes that prevent a lot of the community members to just be able to step on the other side of a certain street because of where they're coming from.
The other big problem she faces here, hesitation to get the vaccine. She says her neighbors are mistrustful of the government and pharmaceutical companies.
The vaccine was made by the devil. It's made by children. I mean, there's a lot of myths out there, and we just have to go out there in the community and dispel a lot of these myths. But what really helps is when I'm at church talking to people, giving an update, and I have the faith leader right next to me saying, yes, get vaccinated. So it's the voices of our community-based organizations, of our faith leaders, sometimes they go a lot further than compared to a city official coming in and just, you know, also saying that messaging.
That's why with each of these mobile sites, the next step after choosing a location is working with community-based organizations that can find local unvaccinated residents and convince them to show up.
We fed our community every weekend, and then we started a lunch program. So, and then we start with the seniors, feeding the seniors, delivering meals to them.
A group called Sisters of Watts helped find the people getting vaccinated today. And it took a lot more work than sharing a post in the neighborhood Facebook group. This effort is led by Robin Daniels.
So Joanna was like, hey, y'all do a lot in the community. We would like y'all to come aboard with us to help with the vaccine, get the word out.
They left flyers on doorsteps.
So we started calling people. We started walking around.
They walked into shopping centers.
We started going door to door, knocking on door to let them know about the vaccine is coming to Watts.
Rodriguez even manned a fruit stand to help someone get vaccinated.
Earlier this week, there was a frutero who couldn't leave his post because he's like, I just can't leave because I'm going to lose on money. So we actually stayed there so he can get vaccinated. And we just waited there until he came back, and we had a line of people waiting for his business.
Daniel says her biggest advantage was being able to quell any fears about getting a shot since she'd already gotten hers.
I was able to say, hey, I got the vaccine. So they say, wow, a lot of people listen to, oh, this happened, that happened. I said, only thing was a sore arm, and that's it. And they say, what? All this about that? I said, no, the sore arm. So that was the good thing about it. I could tell them that Sisters of Watts got the vaccine.
Rodriguez and Daniels told everyone interested when and where to show up. They didn't put any information online because they didn't want affluent people driving long distances to get here. LA City Mobile Manager Daniela Bursa says that's how they make sure the vast majority of patients are from the community.
We don't advertise where we're going to be. We used to for testing, and then I think people were finding out, so the city doesn't advertise that anymore.
Some sites also take walk-up patients, depending on how many people come for their appointments.
We also sign up for the next day here. We've been doing that at our sites, that if you don't have an appointment and we don't have a spot for a walk-up, oh, come back tomorrow. Let me add you to that list tomorrow. Or next week we're going to be blah, blah, blah in this location. So we'll add that person to that, to the following week.
That's how Gilberto Lareos of Linwood ended up getting his vaccine today.
Por medio de mi hija, ella vino a pedir información el día de ayer. Pero como no tenía ella appointment, ella le dijeron que...
He says his daughter asked about getting him a shot when she came the day before. The workers told him to come back today. All the patients here today say they found out about it from people in the community. Someone's sister texted them or someone's aunt referred them. Garciela Bustamante received one of those flyers at her home in Watts. She says she was afraid at first, but then got more comfortable. Sitting in the observation area after getting the shot, she echoed the same message as the rest of the patients. Please, come get vaccinated.
Que no tengan miedo.
Don't be afraid.
Que no tengan miedo, no pasa nada.
Definitely get vaccinated. I definitely recommend you get vaccinated.
In a matter of hours, any remaining proof of what happened in this parking lot this week will be gone, apart from 1,000 people carrying their new vaccination cards. The mobile team gets a couple days off before they're expected at their next stop in Wilmington. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Well, there are some prolific examples of people making a big difference in places like Watts when it comes to the vaccine and those who are vulnerable. But what about Orange County? OC has not been spared from COVID-19's wrath. Deaths from the coronavirus have now passed average yearly cancer deaths in the county. Its daily positivity rate is higher than in LA County. And the Latino population has been hit particularly hard. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano joins us now, as he does every week with KCRW's Orange County Line, to talk about vaccination efforts in OC. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So we just heard about mobile vaccination units and church groups and community-based organizations in Watts leading vaccine efforts. More shots, more arms. Are you seeing similar outreach in OC?
Oh, yeah, that's actually been the saving grace to the embarrassment that has been coronavirus in Orange County. Of course, notoriously, Orange County is a place where you had cities protesting against masks, bonfires against masks, even you had politicians who just didn't believe that coronavirus really was as a big issue as people were making out it to be. But the people who understood it from the beginning were these church groups, and specifically these small nonprofits, health-based nonprofits in the Latino community. So for months now, actually, here in Santana, where my wife's store is, you take a random street, and there's a small little pop-up for COVID testing, for the vaccine itself. They've done just the Lord's work, really.
And we're going to talk about the politicization of the vaccine tomorrow on this program. But I mean, as I mentioned just a moment ago, Gustavo, COVID deaths surpassed yearly deaths from cancer in Orange County, which isn't the case in much of the rest of the country. I mean, why do you think COVID has hit the county so hard, specifically among Latinos?
Yeah, because again, there's just those historical inequities. Places like Santana, like Anaheim, where, you know, my hometown, Garden Grove, just these working class communities that have historically been ignored. You know, nonprofits could only do so much. At some point, you're going to have these city and county governments step up to the plate. And they just waited way too late to think of coronavirus as a real thing. Like, I remember in Santana, which I have covered a lot, like, for the longest time, there was no testing, like, big testing facility in Santana or even a vaccine facility. This despite the mayor and the city council screaming and pleading with the board of supervisors to send one to them. Instead, Anaheim got two of them. There was a vaccine center at the Anaheim Convention Center and one right across the street or down the street in Disney at the Disneyland Resort.
Do the demographics, do you think, of the Latino population there play a role? I mean, the population tends to be a little younger. Until now, the vaccine hasn't really been available to a big segment. I mean, does any of that play into this?
It does, but at the same time, because, yes, I think Latinos, in terms of the population 65 and older, Latinos only make up about 15% of that population, while making up more than a third of Orange County's population. But even the rollout itself, like, you had these big vaccine centers in, like, places like Soca University, all the way down there in Liso Viejo, places where people needed cars and also just someone to transport them. You also had the Athena app. That's how, for months, that was the only way that you could book an appointment to get a vaccine through Orange County, but it was glitchy. It wasn't even out in Spanish for the first couple of weeks or so, despite promises by the county that it was. It was just a disaster. Again, these nonprofits, places like Latino Health Access, like Share Ourselves in Costa Mesa, they're the ones who have been working tirelessly all this time, literally without sleep, to try to address some of those inequities.
And again, to put a finer point on it, that vaccine hesitancy, what we just heard in Kaylee's piece a little while ago, I mean, that was something in your own family as well. I mean, your dad getting Mr. Arellano to get the vaccine, to get the shot, was a pretty tough experience.
Oh, yeah. It was an ordeal. But like I talked about it, my dad eventually said yes. And I think you do have these tendencies, especially among the younger folks with Latinos. Like, I've seen, and I've talked about this before in Santana, where you had parties, you had people not wearing masks. And you could go on, like, on my level, shaming people, calling them names that we're not going to say here on KCRW. But I also advocate on the smaller level, on the person-to-person level, like, trying to reason with them, with love, with care, with, not, if not acceptance, but just really pushing them. And again, this is what these family members of COVID victims and also these nonprofits have been trying to do.
What have organizers, Gustavo, found to be the most effective way to counter that? I mean, you know, you talked about the glitchiness of the app and all of it. I mean, those things seem to have been rectified. What else can be done besides the outreach, besides, you know, more information?
Just again, more, on the personal level, giving them those stories. I've found that most of the people who believe COVID does not exist has not had someone in their family or in their life who has passed away. So literally having those wrenching stories. But also, I think it's important, incumbent actually, upon county and city government to be making those resources available. I did a story for the Times, for instance, in Oxnard, where they had the two zip codes that accounted for 40% of all COVID cases in Ventura County. And just how the activists were saying, look, as something as simple as doing a pop-up testing site at a park in the middle of the barrio, that will make a huge difference. So as cities and especially the county health agency, the more they do that, the easier it's going to be to wrangle down this COVID, especially among Latinos, once and for all.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist with the LA Times. Of course, every week he joins us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is reminiscent of the movie Groundhog Day, but a new short film on Netflix tackles something much more serious.
Let me ask you something. What would you do if somebody was trying to kill you every day?
A black man in a recurring nightmare can't stop getting brutalized or shot by police. It's a nightmare that feels all too real to a lot of Americans.
You got a problem here?
Nah, sir, it's no problem. I'll just offer
a paper.
Is
that a cigarette?
Yes, it is.
Don't smell like no cigarette.
Well, that's how the police confrontation in Two Distant Strangers seems to always begin. The film is nominated for an Oscar. It's also getting some criticism for being too graphic in its depiction of black trauma. Trayvon Free wrote and co-directed the film, and he joins me right now. Trayvon, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So the main character in your film is a guy named Carter. He wakes up, and by the way, this is every guy's dream, right? He wakes up in the really nice apartment of this, you know, beautiful woman. A nice date happened between the two of them. He wakes up in bed with her after, you know, and then you have some post-date typical conversation, you know, I'm not trying to ghost you and stuff like that. I just need to get to my dog.
Right.
That's what he says. He's got to tend to his dog. You're setting up this. This is everyday life, right? This guy is just doing his everyday thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this exemplifies, obviously, what happens to a lot of people. They're just going through their everyday affairs, right? And then something happens.
Yep. No, that's exactly it and exactly the point. You know, we are going through our everyday lives as black people, and we come out of sometimes really joyous and amazing experiences and, well, you know, walk right into a nightmare. Like our joy can turn on a dime. And I wanted to convey and show, you know, just how different that is for us, how our experiences are so jarring emotionally in that way.
You know, each day, Carter tries to do something differently. I mean, trying to avoid getting shot by this New York City police officer, Officer Merck. He tries to run. He tries not running. He stays in the apartment. He tries to make friends with a cop. Nothing seems to work. I mean, and then this toward the end.
Look, I realize now, it don't matter what I say or what I do or how I try to do it. This dude just want to kill me.
Is that what you want people to feel? I mean, that sense of frustration that no matter what you do, it seems like the same outcome every time?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I definitely want that to be part of your journey. I want you to understand how we feel, you know, as black men, as black people, you know, the suffocation we live with every day of every time we leave a place, we have to be concerned. We have to think about our life. And I think that's just not the case for many other people in this country outside of us, that, you know, if you walk out of your house, you have to think about if you're actually coming back. If you walk out of a store, you have to think about if you're actually going to make it home. If you leave someone's house, you have to think about if you're going to actually make it home. And that uncomfortable feeling is a 29-minute experience of our 24-hour experience.
Yeah. This film was inspired, obviously, in large part by the killing of George Floyd. Here we are talking as the jury's about to start deliberating in the Derek Chauvin trial, right? This is the Minneapolis police officer whom we all see, the world saw, put his knee on the neck of George Floyd and watched the breath, you know, leave the life of George Floyd while that was happening. I mean, how does it feel to be doing interviews and preparing for the Oscars at this time?
You know, it's been very conflicting to be in this particular period in time with our film. I think, you know, the fact that our film and its release and its purchase, you know, even by Netflix, coincided with the trial starting and then this past week with Dante Wright. Like, I think it serves as a reminder of why we did this. It was a direct reminder of, you know, why we're here in the first place. It's like, we didn't make this film in vain. We made this film to point out a truth that, you know, a group of people live in this country. And then in the middle of and toward the end of, you know, campaigning the film and promoting the film, like, another young black man is killed by the police. And then the Adam Toledo video is released and you see a boy with his hands in the air and he's killed. And, you know, it's just like, when is enough enough?
What do you say about criticism to you and to other filmmakers about black trauma porn is what I believe some critics are calling it. You know, this is the LA Times today, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
Quote, the growing furor around Hollywood projects containing horrific images of mayhem, maiming, and murder directed at black people. Brutalization of black bodies is presented as entertainment. What do you say to that, to critics who say that this can be pretty triggering?
Yeah, you know, I think, well, for starters, I think it's a very interestingly timed critique of our film, you know, when we've been getting so much love and praise. I mean, it's hard to think of our film as detrimental to Black viewership when we just won the African American Film Critics Association Award for our film, which was judged and chosen by a large body of Black film critics. I don't think you could get much better Black critical validation than that. And I mean, we just actually had a conversation with Yusuf Salam, who was one of the Central Park Five members, and Shaka Sangora, which was a great conversation about this very thing. And, you know, one of the things they said that, you know, was so resonant is that these expressions of our experience that are able to allow people who had no access to our actual thoughts and feelings and no access to our lives to actually experience what it's like to be us, like you would do in a When They See Us. You know, it's those things that help move the needle. I've had so many people tell me how seeing this film changed their perspective on this issue when they thought that they knew everything, when they thought that they'd thought and felt everything and understood every aspect of the story. The one thing they couldn't do was feel what it was like. The one thing they couldn't do was be transported into the body of a Black man, and we take you and put you right in Carter's shoes. And I think there's a difference between doing that and to create a project that is simply made to traumatize. And I would definitely believe our film was made to educate and to help move the needle forward in this conversation.
There's a particular song that plays in the film too. It's The Way It Is by Bruce Hornsby and the Range. This is what, from the 1980s, and its lyrics hit at the core of this subject. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is.
Ah, but don't you believe that? Absolutely. I mean, it was chosen deliberately. You know, that song was written in 1985, the year I was born, and you listen to the lyrics, the chorus, that's just the way it is. Some things will never change. But if you get to the back end of the song, he actually, you know, he adds a line to that chorus, which is, but don't you believe them. And that's our lived experience as Black people. You know, we feel like this is just the way it is and some things will never change because we're still going through this cycle, but we choose not to believe it. We choose to push back and fight back and believe that we can end the phenomenon of police violence against everyone.
Will things ever change? Is it going to happen? Are you hopeful?
You know, I am. I am hopeful because it's the thing that keeps me, you know, resilient in this fight. It's the thing that keeps me, you know, active in spaces that are trying to change the world for everyone, for all types of people. And you know, it's difficult to see a path forward right now. And I don't know if I'll even, you know, be around to see this change happen. And I know we're chipping away at some of these things that are impeding the progress of ending the phenomenon of police violence. And so I hope that we continue to grow as a country and continue to build, you know, generations of people who want to see this changed. Because ultimately, it is the people who can decide, you know, what leaders we elect and who fights this fight for us, you know, from a legislative perspective. And I hope that we can use that power to stop this from being a thing, to stop the police from killing 1,000 people a year.
It certainly is a powerful film. I want to thank you for your time, Trayvon Free, writer, co-director of the Oscar-nominated short film Two Distant Strangers. You can check it out, by the way, on Netflix anytime. Trayvon, thanks. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. That's just the way.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, our coverage of the ramp-up of vaccinations continues. Today, we talked about the people who don't have access or maybe are hesitant for religious reasons, distrust, things like that. Tomorrow, we'll look at the vaccine and how it's become political, with Republicans least likely, according to polls, to get the vaccine. How about letting us know your situation with the vaccine? Have you had your shots? What are you doing differently now that perhaps you haven't been doing for the last year or more? KCRW.com/GreaterLA and let us know. And while you're there, subscribe to the podcast to get every episode of GLA delivered fresh to your feed. Again, KCRW.com/GreaterLA. Catherine Barnes, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geist, Desmond Taylor, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis, honored by your presence. Thanks for your time and attention. Have a great night.